Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Gilcrease Museum at its beginning was devoted to contemporary Indian art. Museum championed artists like Woody Crumbo, Willard Stone, and A.C. Blue Eagle. And this past weekend, the museum opened its first exhibition devoted to a living contemporary Native American artist in recent memory. Rick Bartow is considered one of Oregon's best-known artists, a member of the Wyot tribe of Northern California. His work is utterly contemporary, combining European influences from artists like Chagall and Francis Bacon with the stories and myths of Northwestern Indian tribal culture and Native American transformation stories. Many of the works featured in the exhibit combine animal and human imagery. Rick Bartow, Things You Know But Cannot Explain, is currently on display at Gilcrease Museum through April 24th, featuring over 100 works of paintings, drawings, work on paper, sculpture, as well as giant pastel he's best known for, spanning over 30 years of work. A Vietnam veteran, Bartow's work also displays a life that has been touched by tragedy, PTSD, alcoholism, and most recently, a debilitating stroke. My guest today is gallery owner and longtime representative of Bartow's work, Charles Froelich, who was in town for the exhibit's opening and gave an opening weekend lecture on Bartow's work. Bartow is currently recovering from surgery and has been unable to attend the opening of the exhibit. Charles Froelich is my guest today. Charles Froelich, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Gilcrease Museum has opened, as far as I can remember, the first retrospective exhibit of a living Native American artist. I mean, you'd have to go back to the Gilcrease days when Willard Stone and A.C. Blue Eagle were exhibiting in the museum to see this new exhibit by Rick Bartow.
And Crumbo, yes.
Yeah.
It's a thrill to be a part of a presentation of a living Native American artist that shows the evolution of visual language and visual culture.
You've been involved with Rick Bartow. How did you first meet him?
I met him through my gallery job in Portland, Oregon. I was fairly fresh out of college, and we just hit it off and worked with that gallery for a number of years. And when I opened my gallery, he said he wanted to come along.
And you've been able to see the evolution of his work. And this is something that's really interesting, is how his work has evolved that you see through this show. The show's not set up chronologically. You're seeing all sorts of pieces based on various thematic elements. You can see this evolution of this artist as he becomes maybe more internal as he goes along.
Introspective, for sure.
Yeah.
The last few years have been very introspective. But you'll see in the early work of this exhibition from nearly 40 years ago, that is the maturing moment where Rick starts. The gesture and the mark are combined in a way where you find erasure and you see the figure in a... He's allowing both refined mark and line and depiction and then gestural obliteration.
Yeah.
And it evolves. The subject matter has slowly evolved, and there are phases where he maybe works with only pastel for a year, or maybe acrylic or wood for a year or for a long period, but you still see marks and connection to those. It's a slow evolution, and there is a thread connecting them.
And I love you sort of were getting at what I was seeing at first glance of seeing his work. There's this mix of refinement and almost a primitive quality to it equally, in which you'll see a very primitive detail over most of the canvas, and all of a sudden this little small section will be just utterly refined.
He's highly articulate with representation, but he also feels that, you know, an exact photorealist rendering is going to be a little stagnant. So putting gesture and mark and emotion into it is a way to really give it pop.
Well, when people go to Gilcrease to see Things You Know But Cannot Explain, which I was thinking, okay, this is a metaphorical title for the show, but in fact, what?
Yes, it is a reference to...
Well, there's one piece that's called this.
Yes, there is one drawing called that, and there's a German philosopher from many ages ago that talked about a person trying to express their belief in God. And you can't touch it, taste it, feel it, but if you have that intuition, it's in your gut, but it's sometimes difficult to express. And making art and expressing things through art and introspection and expressing yourself can sometimes be that. For Rick, he's drawing his emotions, he's interpreting his life through visual language, and maybe that speaks louder than words.
Now, how much of his tribal identity goes into this artwork? Obviously, we're seeing coyotes and bears and crows and ravens in the subject matter of his artwork. How does that relate to his own Native American heritage?
Rick has said he had a foot in each camp. His father was Native of the Wiat tribe of Northern California, and his mother is Anglo-Christian. And he would go to church in the morning, and then they'd go to powwow in the afternoon. His mother was as respective of his father's ancestry as his father was of his mother's ancestry. So Rick grew up with multiple identities, living a parallel and very balanced life. The visual tradition, though, is a little more complex in his work. Living on the West Coast, and Oregon is not quite the far northwest coast, and you might think of formline design, formline from the Haida and the Tlingit and the mass carving that is so formally clean and reserved. He studied that, and he knows a lot of those wood carvers, and he loves that work. But he takes some of that influence. He travels to Japan. He's traveled to New Zealand and Mexico. And so carvers and artists from many cultures, Maori, Ainu in Japan, but contemporary artists. So he's not just a Native artist. He is definitely a bicultural, multicultural visual omnivore.
I was going to say, I see a lot of Francis Bacon, too.
Oh, he is crazy about Francis Bacon.
In a lot of his portrait work, it's like not derivative in any sense, but you can see that there's a sense of that sort of proportion on the paper or canvas that seems to follow him around.
I cannot stress enough how much he looks and reads. He loves looking at exhibitions of peers or historic work. So ways of expressing, he's always wanting to fine-tune that. But he also never wants to mimic. He wants to make it authentic. He wants to make his mark and gesture authentic and personal. They're his own stories, his own life that he's interpreting. And you do see that he has nods by mentioning artists in titles like For Klimt, For Fritz, After Sheila, After Janssen.
Yeah. When you go to the exhibit, as you walk down the main hallway of Gilcrease, in fact, the exhibit spills over into the main hallway because it's a little larger than the room they usually have for exhibits. But the first big piece that you see is this sculpture from 2004 from Nothing Coyote Creates Himself.
Yes.
And this is a good introduction to sort of the ethos behind him, because it is a large wooden sculpture that features a human hand on one end and a coyote head on the other. Very long horizontal sculpture, primitive in a way, yet again refined.
Yes, part of major part of that sculpture is the sinuous, lean line, and it is a root from a cedar tree that was buried however many hundreds of years ago, and then in a recent landslide or in the 1990s, it was washed up from a landslide, and he saw this long root, and it just had this beautiful line. So here's a found element, and then you have the hand on one end, very large hand, proportionate, and it's like a surrealist gesture of this hand stretching through time. And at the very opposite end is the coyote head, which also has a little bird spirit sticking out of the back, kind of whispering in its ear. So you see this metaphor of the animals talking to each other and then the human and the coyote kind of communing.
Yeah. No, it's a really striking piece. And it also helps as you're going through the exhibit, you see all these transformation pictures, which I call them transformation. There's one piece, I think it's called Bear Coming, in which you have a human form, but it's almost as if the bear inside is emerging and you see the snout coming out where the facial features, the mouth would be, and you start seeing this literally a bear coming through this human form. The human form is sort of ethereal, if you will, and yet this bear is, again, this sort of sense of refinement of it. It, you know, this snout is just very, very realistically rendered.
Yes, the bear is so present, and the human figure, the silhouette, the identity of a human is equally present.
And that seems to be a theme he returns to, this sort of melding of animals and human forms.
Transformation is a word a lot of people use in describing Rick's work, and there are myths that you can find all over the globe. Egyptian, Mexican, Biblical, Japanese, folk tales, Native American. They include, you know, whether it's the stick being thrown down and turning into a snake or animals turning into humans. But it also is about us humans paying close attention to animals, whether it's the sincerity and innocence of a deer or the accurate tactical thinking of an eagle or an osprey or the fierce protective instinct of a bear mother. And there are a lot of faces that are part animal, part human, and he pays so close attention to the animals of the Western Oregon landscape.
My guest today is Charles Froelich, a gallery owner who represents Rick Bartow. Gilcrease Museum is presenting the first retrospective in my memory of a living Native American artist, Rick Bartow, Things You Know But Cannot Explain, on display at Gilcrease Museum. And Charles is my guest today. One of the things I think is the strongest part of his work is this sense of emotion and deep welling emotions that seem to be a part of his work. There's a section of the show that are a series of self-portraits. I was really taken by one that's a very relatively small little piece. It's a little triptych called PTSD 1, 2, and 3. And, of course, I was drawn to something that you'll find yourself drawn as you go throughout the exhibit, eyes. He paints these incredibly mesmerizing eyes, even in a piece that might be, for the most part, figuratively abstract. There will be an eye that is just looking at you.
Mm-hmm. Rick is
somewhat creepy, and yes. At the same time, but it's arresting at the least.
Rick is an empath and an introspective artist. And to express emotion, when he was 5, he lost his father. His father died. His experience in the Vietnam War, seeing the mutilation and coming back with survivor's guilt and bottoming out after that and then balancing his life, really becoming whole again and finding the love of his life and watching her die from breast cancer, he said, you know that when the lights go out in someone's eyes, that's it. So the power of what an eye can express in his artwork is very important to him. And they are sparkly, they're full of life, they're full of pathos, they're full of joy. He celebrates the birth of his children, he mourns the loss of his loved ones. And there are people that have said, oh, they're frightening, and these open mouths, are they screaming, are they in pain and agony? Well, to return to a question about tradition, chanting and singing is a very big part of tribal ceremony for him in the sweat lodge. And when you chant or when you sing, I bet if you went to take photos of choir members or singers, it's hard for a photographer to take a photo of a blues singer that's just singing their heart out without sometimes making it look like they're in agony, but they're emoting, they're projecting. And a chant or a song, a hymn, those are very much emotive expressions. And he is presenting those in his work too.
Now, it was funny because in that little triptych, I was seeing three separate emotions in those three little panels. One was almost of confusion. And, of course, it's hard to get a sense because you were talking about mutilation, you know, and these three portraits, which were realistically done, have this big, huge black stripe across the bottom half of each of the frames. But the first seemed to be of confusion. The middle seemed to be of anger. And the third was almost apathy. It was almost apathetic. It's or resignation, maybe.
He came back from Vietnam at a time and people called it shell-shocked, or it was not the easiest time to transition back into normal life. And the experiences of war, the horrors of war, are so complex. And thank goodness for modern evolution of understanding. But that is, he's always recognized he has PTSD.
Yeah. He could have easily been a lost soul, probably.
He very well could have been.
Yeah. In the course of the exhibit, I have to talk about a few pieces. One, which actually the show uses as a background for all of the language, is a wonderful self-portrait from about 1984.
I love that drawing.
Which you know, it's this oblique self-portrait with a
cigarette in his mouth.
With a cigarette in his mouth. And it almost looks like early Picasso-esque in a way. You know,
the colors are, it's the
blue
the 70s.
Palette. Yeah.
From that blue palette, it's like, oh, pastel. And it's his beginning to understand the power of erasure and the balance of refined and gestural mark. It's a tender self-portrait, and it's a recurring subject for him, the self. He's introspective, for sure. What's his place in the world? Where does he stand in the world? What is his mark on the world? What does he do for the world? So putting a vision, an image of himself, that's how he, partly how he expresses that.
And you can contrast that with a much larger piece from, I think it was around 2001, in which it's almost this ghostly outline. You know, you see his face is haggard, it's long, but it almost has this ghostly sort of veneer to it.
His life has gone through a lot of transitions.
Yeah. My guest today is Charles Froelich, a gallery owner who represents Rick Bartow. Gilcrease Museum is featuring a retrospective of Rick Bartow, Things You Know But Cannot Explain, contemporary Native American artist from Oregon. It features a lot of, I have to say, it has this Northwest feel to a lot of his work. And I don't know what that Northwest feel is exactly, but it has nothing to do with mask, which is what we think of Native American culture and craft in that part of the world. But there's something about it that seems to say Northwest.
Well, Rick is so experimental with painting, sculpture, drawing, printmaking. He's tried his hand at ceramic, a little bit of glass work, not that there's glass in this show. And experimentation with media is a common experience now, where it's not just I'm a painter and that's all I do, or artists are only bronze sculptors and that's all they do. There are a lot of peers of Rick's that work in multiple media.
Yeah, and you see that, you can almost see, like when you're looking at the year when something was created, okay, well, this must have been a pastel year.
Oh, yes.
And then there's a sculpture year where, and I'm glad you mentioned the sculptures, because there are a number of sculptures. Some look like they involve a lot of found objects and a lot of pieced wood sculptures, where he's just taking scraps of wood and creating a beautiful object or interesting object at sometimes, but beautiful object at other times.
A scrapyard is at his doorstep because he can go out to the Pacific Ocean, to the beach, and see what the tide brought in. And so there will be driftwood, there will be found, you know, industrial pieces that have washed up.
A lot of nails, apparently.
A lot of nails, yes. And that the nails really harken back to a specific experience of seeing African Kondi sculpture, and that effort of someone in a community putting a nail into a sculpture to either extract or wake up something, an entity that would listen. Or I'm sure there are many inaccurate theories on Kondi sculpture, but visually it's a powerful sculpture to look at, this object covered with nails. And sometimes it's just to represent fur or hair or
a mane.
You know, gnarly. Yeah, mane. But it can also be anguish.
And knowing that he's using driftwood and things like that in his work gives a new understanding of some of these pieces you see. There's this one piece that's really quite dynamic. It's a animal figure, but it's almost hooded. He's taken this wire mesh, which looks like scrap wire metal mesh of some sort, and sort of created this mask of the facial figure.
The found object comes into play a lot for Rick. It's an accretion, an accumulation of something that already has a feeling to it and something that he can carve and whittle or make new. So there's milled wood and finely carved wood, and there are found objects. Sometimes for teeth, he's very playful with teeth. So you might see pencil tips for teeth or toothpicks or dentures. People have brought him roadkill. And, you know, once an artist starts using one little animal part, have to be careful, because, you know, if you tell people I have penguin glasses at home, then everybody starts to bring you penguin glasses. Well, All of a sudden, the garbage man thought Rick needs more roadkill. So that was a funny phase of his artwork.
Well, you know, as you go through the show, this emotion, and I think it's because of these eyes that he paints that they just show up so strongly that, you know, they're really arresting. But there's also some wonderful humor in a lot of these pieces. There's this wonderful sculpture, it's a wall sculpture of a salmon, in which it's basically a sculpture of a fish, but there's embedded in the middle of it where the gills would be, it's like there's this little human face and a hand.
Right.
And a set of eyes and the tail.
The interdependence of species, humans and animals, bears and salmon. The salmon are an iconic and ever-present in the Pacific Northwest. The dammed rivers and the plight of the return of the salmon and our constant fear of will they come back from the ocean. They spend part of their life in the freshwater and they're born in the freshwater and then they go out to sea to grow and mature, and then they come back to spawn again in the freshwater where they were born. And it's an iconic symbol. It is about bounty and its sustenance, but the relationships of eels and salmon, bears and salmon, he loves those, using those multiple layered narratives.
Some of the most interesting pieces, I thought, which I think I'm going to have to go back and look at them to even get a good sense of them, is this section called Gesture. These are these very large pieces with lots of white space and these just sort of they're abstract. They're completely abstract in their own way.
It's pretty energetic to watch him work. Yeah. He'll staple 5 large pieces of paper on his studio wall and then just start going at it in an aerobic exercise like effect. He's grabbing pastels just from one color to the next. It's not necessarily like, oh, I need blue now. He's just grabbing in a kind of a fit to get new color and get something else on the paper. Gesture is to him, it's crucial in expediency, speed, but you look and you also see such articulate line work in the midst of this gesture. So there's a melee of rubbing and explosive color and mark, and you see a pencil line with the little curve of a shoulder or a knuckle, and you understand exactly, you see that he knows the figure so well.
Yeah.
Careful observation.
Yeah, and the figure is in nearly everything I saw, there was at least some form of a figure in virtually everything in the exhibit.
By leaving so much out, it allows the viewer to fill in spaces too. There's a, you know, horror vacui of, you know, some artists want to fill every inch, but Rick also loves paper. So maybe you're referring to some of the handmade paper works where he just says, oh, the paper's got to speak for itself. It's got its own emotion to it because someone made it.
Yeah. And the other thing that comes out about his work is, you know, a lot of times you'll see an artist that is always trying to evolve, but they evolve very much within sort of their vocabulary. I see Rick, if you want to take that metaphor out, he's exploring other cultures and other languages because in the course of this show, you'll see one thing I was struck by in the works on paper area was these little botanicals. You know, I mean, there's nothing in his work that would suggest, you know, okay, I'd like to do some botanicals. And all of a sudden, there's these 4 or 5, one just exquisite botanical, and then others where he's done a botanical on a song list.
Mm-hmm. Found papers. Botanicals are, he has made them throughout his career.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But they're a lesser known part because people just have been more drawn to the emotional work. But Morris Graves of the Northwest Mystics, the Japanese still lives in Ikebana and scroll paintings. Piet Mondrian, his early botanics are so delicate and eloquent. And you can put every emotion into a flower if you're doing it right.
Yeah. Well, and when you normally have a living retrospective, you expect the artist to be there. But, of course, he's not in really great health right now. In fact, the work of the last 2 years has been profoundly affected by his health. And what's really amazing is when you see work from 2013 and 2014, he's recovering from a major stroke.
Dramatic change in his work, Rich. He had a stroke in 2013, which affected his speech, not his physical dexterity, but he has aphasia. And this took away all of the lyrics to his songs. He's written music for 40 years, all original music, and in the ambulance ride to the hospital, they all went out of his head.
Wow.
All of his songs gone. This is a major experience for anyone. And he said things have to be different. And his speech therapist ingrained that in him. It's relearning how to draw. And he doesn't have to draw or paint the same way. And he's quite often really done that intuitively. But it was a good affirmation that that he can evolve and change. And Rick has, on other occasions in his work, gone back and forth from left hand to right hand, and it shows. You think, boy, did he ask a child to write this, to spell these words? But he's going back and forth, left to right, and I've seen him draw and make large work where he takes the brush from right hand to left hand, and it is sometimes more articulate with the left. He wants to keep challenging his mind. It's a new way of interpreting and expressing.
Mm, well,
and also the ABC 1-2-3.
Yeah, right.
That is the ABC 1-2-3 repetition is his trying to grasp onto some semblance of memory of written and verbal skill.
And what's really interesting is you see this very, very childish scrawl along the canvas, but yet the image seems to have had no effect whatsoever, as far as, you know, maybe some of the fine motor skills, but really, from what I'm seeing on the canvas, you don't see any sort of difference.
It was almost like a new lease on life. After he stole a pencil from a nurse in the hospital, and he got a piece of paper and he drew a bird, and he wrote me a text, "I'm going to be okay." And so, I love it that here he is 69 years old or 68 years old and writing text to me from the hospital. And but he goes into the studio, and after his stroke, he's made the largest paintings of his life. He made 6x8 foot paintings, which you'll see in this exhibition.
No.
He had a pacemaker installed this September to help alleviate his congestive heart failure. And after the pacemaker, he completed an 18-foot wide painting. The largest he's ever created. He's in this world, and he doesn't want to be satisfied with some past accomplishment or accolade. He wants to break new territory. He wants to make new work.
And you can see that some of that new work, along with work over his entire career at Gilchrist Museum. Charles, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Charles Froelich is a gallery owner and longtime representative for contemporary Native American artist Rick Bartow's work. He was in town for the new exhibit opening at Gilchrist Museum titled Rick Bartow, Things You Know But Cannot Explain, which is on display at Gilchrist Museum through April 24th. For more information, visit gilchrist.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.